I think I'll get going. Thanks so much for coming out, you guys. This is really fantastic. This is actually my first time at South By, and for some reason I had this like image that I'd be in like a tiny meeting room or like a gymnasium, like a beat up gymnasium or something like that. And then yesterday I came by, I was like, oh, I'll, you know, go check where I'm going to speak. And I poked my head through this door over here, right, like next to the screen. And I was like, are you kidding me? What is going on? Oh my gosh. So this is like a pleasant surprise. It's fantastic. And I appreciate you, your interest and your support and just coming out today. So, yeah, I think, you know, without any further ado, let's get started. Let's see. Actually, whoa, wait a minute. Sorry, one second. Oh my God. Oh, wait. I hate Lion so much. I think Lion reverted my presentation. I was gonna, oh no. All right, whatever, here, I'll just go forward. All right, so Lion reverted my presentation, so I actually had a joke for you guys in the beginning, but that is not gonna be the case anymore. So it's gonna be all serious. Unfortunately, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. That's unfortunate. That versioning is insane. So anyways, I'm just going to, you know, quickly introduce myself. My name is Jason Rhea. That is my email, jason.rhea@gmail.com. If you guys have any questions, comments while this thing's going on, if you just kind of want to give me some, you know, if you want to send me praise, criticism, or new ideas, just send them to me. I'm always trying to, you know, kind of enhance my ideas, enhance exactly kind of a... you know, the kind of different models I use and the different kind of like psychological information I use. And so if you have any ideas or anything, please shoot them to me. I'm always looking for feedback. Second thing is that the talk that's kind of laid out within the guide or the manual, whatever you want to call that South By guide, I was being extremely optimistic, I think, when I wrote that. And there's I'm not going to be able to get to probably about half or two-thirds of that information. That's probably about a 2.5-hour talk, I realized, after I kind of built the slides for them. So I'm going to put slides up on persuasive.ly, which is my blog, and I'm also going to write some articles kind of like breaking down kind of these different ideas, you know, ideas about like the neurobiology of addiction, pretty much how that applies to like web design, also about reinforcement theory and all that. So I'll break that all down for you guys on the blog, but I'm not going to be able to go through all of that here today, unfortunately. So what am I doing right now and who am I? So I am co-founder of a behavior-driven design consultancy with my buddy Carl right here. He's in the darkness up front. So pretty much, yeah, we do kind of redesigns, big redesigns, and a lot of product design for startups, mainly in Silicon Valley. I'm also UX advisor at 500 Startups, where I'll help the portfolio companies with kind of user experience product design issues. My background is that I actually originally have a background in design and kind of painting, fine arts, but I studied neuroscience at Stanford. And I was also a researcher in the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. And a lot of the ideas I'm going to share with you today are going to be ideas that I really kind of gained when I worked in that lab and ideas I helped develop in that lab. And so that is kind of the background. Check out the work of the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab if you're interested in this area. I think that they're doing a lot of really great stuff. So what am I going to share with you today? I'm going to share a framework. And then the question becomes, you know, why do we need a framework? Like, what's the whole point of giving me a behavior model, a behavior framework, or anything like that? Well, the reason is because I think that it's common very, very much within like the psychological sciences and within neuroscience especially to pretty much get a ton of different facts and tips and tricks, right? So you'll read articles that say like 11 goal hacks, how to achieve anything. And it'll say, you know, it'll give you tips like start committing, start starting, visualize the process, not the outcome. And you get all, and these are all research backed. Like, you know, there are actually studies done at universities to kind of like, you know, kind of to see whether or not the results are statistically significant. But the big problem is that you're pretty much being given a big list of tips and tricks without any understanding of why they're working. The question becomes, oh, well, like, why does, if I start committing, like, why does that work? And what am I actually changing? Like, what's going on? And I think that, you know, there are a lot of these decks coming out today, and I'm actually a huge fan of this deck. It's the Design with Intent deck by Dan Lochten, but it's a collection of 101 cards, and each card has a different kind of like behavior change technique or tactic you can try. And they're really great, but once again, it's like the question becomes, what are we changing here? And like, really, what are we doing? Why, if I get somebody to, let's say, like, why if I engage a person's emotions, are they going to be more likely to do this behavior over another behavior? Like, why does that work? And so these questions kind of keep coming up as we kind of learn these tips and tricks. decks. I mean, another example of kind of these cards, mental notes, right? It's just a, it's a big deck full of cards, so you can go through and you can kind of say, you can get ideas for how to apply psychology to your, to your, to your web design process, right? So you can be like, oh, interesting, I'll add social proof to my, to my process, or to my product, and maybe by adding social proof, what I'll be able to do is I'll, you know, get people like marginally, like more likely to, you know, follow this behavior, this behavior pattern, or whatever it may be. In addition, I think that one of the best examples of this is Robert Cialdini's book Influence, which I'm actually a huge fan of. But the question becomes like, okay, like why does getting somebody to kind of commit make them more likely to perform a certain behavior? When should I actually get somebody to do this? So like, is the commitment bias like, is that useful for like a one-time compliance, or should I actually like build that into my product so that I can actually create habits? Like, how do I use this stuff? And I think that that's where the big problem comes in. One more quick example. Gamification. I think that, you know, with gamification, you know, you pretty much have this in this. The question becomes, you know, it's like, okay, I want to get more engagement and retention on my website. I want people to really enjoy the process more and to come back and to keep using it. So how do I do that? And instead of like thinking in terms of a model, instead of thinking in terms of like, you know, in a structured kind of step by step way, instead. With gamification, I think that the trend I've seen is that people just say, oh, let's put like a reward system into our game, into our product, let's have badges, let's have points, let's have all these different things. And yeah, that does work sometimes, and especially works for like kind of short-term engagement, but the question becomes why? Like, and what's going on here? Like, what are we doing? What are we changing? And so the question becomes, why do these tactics work? What are we changing? And I want to kind of teach you guys today a model, I think, that will really help you kind of break down kind of different kind of behaviors within your day-to-day lives and also within your kind of like product design lives. And the model was made by one of my mentors, BJ Fogg. I'm sure many of you know his work. And so BJ leads the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. And the model I'm really going to teach you guys today is called the Fogg Behavior Model. And some of you may have seen this before, but hopefully I'm going to present it in a somewhat new light, in a new light, and in a way that'll allow you to kind of like connect it more with kind of your product design, web design efforts. And as I said before, I think Lion did revert my presentation a little bit, so there may be a couple of little, you know, hookups or hangups within the presentation, but I'll try to correct for that. So the question that this model really kind of tries to answer is, what causes behavior? So what needs to come together in order for behavior to occur? And according to the Fogg behavior model, it's pretty much three things, right? So three things need to coincide in the same moment in order for a behavior to occur. What do you guys think those things are? Anybody want to shout out an answer? What do you think needs to be there in order for a behavior to occur? Oh, wow. Desire, craving. Okay. These are all great answers. That's awesome. And some of you, I can tell, already know the model. But so the three things are ability, motivation, and it's called trigger. Trigger can also, you can call that a cue as well. It's sort of like pretty much a reminder. And if you remember one thing from the talk today, just remember these three things and just analyze all the behaviors in your life according to these three things. And I'm going to teach you how to kind of like break it down throughout the rest of the talk and how to really kind of analyze these things. But just remember, three things need to coincide within a moment in order for behavior to occur. You have ability, you have to have a certain degree of ability to perform the behavior. You have to have a certain degree of motivation to perform the behavior. And you pretty much have to be triggered or cued to perform the behavior. And there are huge implications just, I think, from these three very simple little categories. So here's kind of one example, and the slide was different until like 15 minutes ago. But so let's say you want to fly a rocket. Well, what do you need in order to fly a rocket? Well, you need some shell that will kind of like allow you to kind of like channel the fuel so that you can actually get like a really cool, like kind of, you can have a really cool tube and fly way up high in the air. You need to have a certain like ability, or there needs to be a context kind of like shaping pretty much just the raw drive, the raw fuel, the raw power, right? And that is like the shell, and we can, you know, compare that to ability. And then finally, you need a catalyst. You need something to kind of like to take like this inherent kind of potentiality, this inherent potential energy, and kind of like just shoot it way up into the stratosphere, right? And that's sometimes how I like to think about the behavior model. You can come up with like, you know, all the cool metaphors and kind of analogies that you want, but that one just kind of helps me sometimes. But I think that there's actually kind of an interesting kind of thing we can notice about these three items, and it's that one of them is much different than the other two, right? So two of these things are always there. They're always inherent within users, within people, within organisms, right? So right now, for any behavior I come up with in the entire world, I can assign you an ability and a motivation score, right? So I can pretty much say, like, okay, let's do an example of like going running. Like right now, most of you have a very low ability to go running. Maybe some of you have running shoes on. Maybe some of you don't have any bags here. And so really, if I push you hard enough, you could just get outside and just like sprint and just go sprinting. But most of you are going to be held back by like the things you have here, by pretty much the shoes you have on, by just kind of the context, right? You're at a conference. It'd be kind of weird to just get up and go running right now. But you do have like, but there is an ability score that I can kind of assign to you. And in addition, Each of you has a specific motivation to do that behavior, right? And I can attach an ability score and a motivation score to any behavior I want, right? And for most of them, it's like your ability right now is zero, like to go skydiving. Your ability to go skydiving right now is zero, but I can still assign you a score to it, and it's still within the realm of all possibilities. And so the okay, cool. The whole point is that the context shapes ability. And pretty much you also, in any given moment, have a motivation to do certain behaviors, right? And the motivations, you know, there's an amazing dance and interplay between, you know, like you and your background and all the cues you're getting on a subconscious level and all these things that kind of like determines your motivation to do certain things. And, you know, depending on how much insulin's been released, you're going to be hungry or not. But, you know, let's forget all these complexities and just say that at any given time you have a motivation and it tends to fluctuate per given behavior throughout the day. And so what I can do is I can combine those two things, right? I can add your motivation score and your ability score, and we can kind of create a graph saying, okay, this is your motivation and ability. This is like your overall, like, we could call it maybe ability or like potentiality for doing a behavior, and we could put it into kind of a graph like that. And what I had in a slide until a few minutes ago was there's actually like we can draw a line which we can call the activation threshold pretty much across this graph, so we can see like what times in the day are you actually going to be likely to respond to a cue with a behavior, right? So most of the day it's like, you know, your motivation ability is kind of low. Like in the morning when you get up, you have free time because you get up at 6, you have to be at work by 9. So you have free time, you have your shoes at home, you do have some energy because you just woke up, and you know, we can break it down many different ways. And then in the evening when you get back home, you're kind of tired after work, but you do have your shoes and access to everything. So your motivation and ability are a bit higher at the end of the day. And so what we can do actually, and I had this before, like I said, is that you can draw a line across and you can say, oh cool, so if I trigger this person to go running in the morning after they've woken up, and then at the certain point after they've come back from work, when it's not too late in the evening, so therefore they're not too tired, then this trigger is likely to be met with a behavior. And so that's kind of a cool way that you can kind of use, you can kind of like break down, you know, a behavior. So like I said before, ability plus motivation plus trigger equals behavior. And so let's go into each of the elements in a bit more depth. So ability, and I'm going to relate it to web design and everything here too. So what is ability? What determines somebody's ability, right? How do we break it down? How do we actually analyze ability? And BJ came up with what he calls his ability factors for this. And actually, in a couple of his articles, if you look them up on Google, he actually calls these the 6 elements of simplicity as well. But the more recent kind of term he's been switching towards is the ability factors. So that explains like the discrepancy. So BJ says that, you know, kind of 6 things kind of determine a person's ability to do a behavior within any moment. One thing is how much time they have, right? Kind of like, do they have any commitments in the near future? Do they actually have a lot of time to perform the behavior? If the behavior like takes half an hour or 45 minutes and you only have 15 minutes, your ability is pretty much zero in that situation. Money, right? You may want to go skydiving, but if you only have $100 in your bank account and skydiving costs $300, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to do that behavior. Physical effort, which is just, you know, how energized are you? Are you rested? All these things like that. Mental effort, you know, certain people really love puzzles and challenges and like kind of recalling information. Some people don't. And sometimes you're really tired at the end of the day and are just mentally fried and you just don't have the mental effort to go through with the behavior. And then he also has social deviance and non-routine. social deviance is just like, how strange is this behavior? Is it kind of like appropriate for the context? And then non-routine is like, do you have experience with this behavior? Have you ever done this behavior before? Do you know what's going on? Are you going to have to kind of like fiddle around and like try many different ways and fail a couple times before you get it? Or is it just something like you understand, you have a mental model for it, you've done it before, boom, let's go. And I've found these to be extremely useful. So I usually kind of on, not as explicitly anymore, but on kind of more of like just like more of like a subconscious level, always go through kind of these elements whenever I'm kind of like analyzing usability when I'm designing anything pretty much. And actually one way that I like to look at it is like, I think that time is kind of a proxy for like how hard or how streamlined the experience is, right? With users a lot of time, one thing I've noticed is that a user will say, man, I don't have the time to use this. Like, this really is too much time. But the same user will go, you know, kind of twiddle around and like things on Facebook for 2 hours later that day and like make comments and stuff like that. It's not generally not an issue of time. Like, I don't have the time for this. In some situations, like if you want somebody, let's say, this isn't really an online behavior, but let's say you want somebody to go on like a half an hour run with you and they only have like, you know, they have to be at dinner in 20 minutes. Yeah, in that situation, they don't have the time. But generally for online behaviors, one thing I've noticed is that pretty much we can always design them so that they are streamlined and like really simple and that don't require too much information, don't require too much text, don't require too much decision-making. And generally, when a user looks at something and feels overwhelmed and they don't think that they have the time to kind of perform a given behavior or use a specific app, generally it's because we haven't taken the time to really streamline the experience and kind of simplify it down. And that's what ability is all about, simplification. It's all about getting to the core of the experience. And so one question I think you can always ask in terms of ability, you know, to figure out, you know, userability, in order to kind of analyze userability, always ask, are we asking for too much? Are we asking for too much from the user? So you can extend that to kind of BJ's list of different ability factors, right? And you can say things like, are we asking for too much money? And that's the great thing about kind of like, you know, the freemium models that we have right now. There's a low barrier to entry option. So it's like, oh, free, yeah, you know, just try it out. You know, so there's no ability barrier there. So you can come in, and then if you want to, you can kind of jump up to the next level. You know, sometimes, you know, cost is a true kind of ability barrier. Like, I was trying to sign up for this, I think that the reason they did this is because they don't have it, it's not ready yet, and so, or something, but I was trying to sign up for this service called Zero Mail, and they have this, this note is like $100 beta account. And, you know, I don't want to spend $100 on a beta account for something I haven't even used yet, and so, therefore, in that situation, money was a true ability barrier for me. And I think, you know, the classic kind of econ demand curve kind of explains kind of the relationship between cost and therefore like kind of ability to participate. Next question you could ask, right? And it's something along the lines of, are we asking for too much text? And you can kind of compare that to BJ's physical effort kind of category, which is that. So I mean, here's a little story, right? So the other day I was on the bus and the iPad came out. And I had the iPad 2, and I just really wanted that Retina display. And so I went on my phone, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to buy the Apple iPad on my phone. So I went on my phone, and then I got to this page, and I'm just terrible at typing on the iPhone, even though I've, you know, had one for like 3 or 4 years. I just can't do it. I always get, you know, like, I mince letters and everything. And so I got on to this page, and I was filling everything out. And the bus was bumpy, and I was just going all over the place. And it was just too much text for me to enter in order to actually fulfill this behavior. And also at the same time, you know, like when you're on your iPhone and you're on like a, you're on a page not, you know, kind of designed for mobile, and when you click on a form field, it zooms in, and so you can't see the rest of the page, and so you have to kind of click around. It was just a huge pain, and it was asking, there's so much text I had to fill out in order to check out. I wasn't able to actually perform the behavior. So that's a good example, I think, of, you know, kind of like text, kind of text entry, or too much text entry being kind of a barrier to a behavior occurring. I mean, kind of a great kind of example of the power of like limitations and simplification is Twitter. Right, so Twitter pretty much, you know, with traditional blogging, it's like open-ended. Write as much as you want. Twitter says, okay, like we're going to actually increase the average user's ability to write kind of cool content by actually giving them a constraint so that they can't go too crazy or so the expectations aren't too high or anything. Let's actually just give them, you know, whatever it is. It's 140 characters, I believe. And so you can, you know, type in your message and just really quickly by increasing user ability by actually simplifying the product and applying constraints, they were able to actually, you know, kind of increase user behavior. Another question could be, are we asking for too much information? And to be completely candid, I was having kind of a hard time kind of thinking of a service where where they actually ask for too much information. And but I knew that like I had had an experience. I've had many experiences where I was not able to either sign up for a service or complete a behavior because of information I did not have handy on me. And like, you know, one example I kind of thought of was, actually, I just saw this the other day. There's this insane, there's this absolutely insane passport. I think it's like a passport questionnaire. This page is actually not the most insane one. On the next one, they ask for like, I think it's like grandmother, where she worked and like, you know, between these years and stuff like that. And it's just like crazy information that like a lot of people just one are not going to have on hand. And two, information that, you know, this is kind of like barrier to entry information, barrier to behavior information. And I guess the entire point of applications is to actually, in a certain sense, filter people out or weed people out. And so in those situations, it would make sense to have high ability barriers. But that's a certain example. And actually, that's why I think that moving this movement towards a kind of like Facebook registration plugin, Facebook Connect, is pretty awesome, because you actually don't have to, one, remember all of your information, two, type it in every time you sign up for something. And so this kind of lowers the ability barriers towards like entering text, remembering information, typing in new information into the sign up process. And so this is just like a mini list I came up with of kind of like ways that you can look at ability. And you know, it's really hard to be kind of general and to kind of come up with like an all-inclusive list for every kind of product design project. Usually what I like to do when I'm in a product, when we're starting a new kind of product design project, is what I like to do is think about, okay, in order for the users to have the core experience, what is all the information, what are all the inputs we absolutely need, and kind of write that out. And then pretty much what I'll do is I'll go through all those different pieces of information, all those different inputs we need from the user, and just say, are we asking for too much in this situation? Can we get by? Can we do something clever in order to like not ask them for that, or in order, you know, to have them not and like upload their picture or whatever it may be? So really trying to kind of like simplify down all the information and all the different user inputs that we really are asking for. And so with web design, I think that that's what it's all about. And it really, like as I said before, it's about getting to the core of the experience. What's absolutely necessary? Let's get rid of everything else. And I think actually kind of a good example of that is Instagram, right? Before you had Instagram, you had Bourbon. And it's been a long time since I've used Bourbon. I don't remember all the exact features, but I mean, you could like, if I remember correctly, like upload video, you put status, you could create status updates. It was kind of like Path-ish, if I remember correctly. And pretty much at one point, you know, they weren't getting enough user adoption. Cut, you know, all the other features, and suddenly you just have, you know, social photo sharing, and it's awesome and it's terrific because it's a much simpler application, has lower barriers to entry, it's more understandable in many different ways. It's just so much better in terms of ability. And so I think that, you know, their success kind of just shows the power of simplification. So that's ability. Let's move on to motivation a little bit. And I think that you guys can analyze motivation on kind of two levels. Right, there's the product-wide level, the motivation to use the product on the product-wide level, and then there's also kind of the screen-to-screen level. And I think that the main question to ask for the product level is, does the product actually solve a true pain point? Does this bring the person from like kind of like a negative state or a negative, you know, affect to a positive affective state? Are we actually helping them, right? Or another way to frame this is, are we actually providing users with value, right? So that you can also just be an entertainment app. If I frame it this way, it can also be an entertainment app. People are feeling good. We can help make them feel better. We can bring kind of value to their lives. And I kind of have some strong opinions about kind of the motivation kind of component of behavior, because I generally think that, you know, so when I was younger, I played a lot of video games. And with most video games, kind of the behavior pattern I saw with myself was, you'd get a game, you'd be obsessed with it, I'd be obsessed with it, and I'd play it for, you know, 40 or 50 hours, beat it, and then pretty much, you know, I'd bring it to Goodwill or like give it to a friend or something like that. I'd be done with the game, right? And I kind of think that we see kind of a similar pattern with products that don't solve true kind of life and user problems. Or is that I think that if you're not solving a true problem, you'll be treated like a game, right? And so you see this a lot with different kind of like web apps and different web services, where it's like users will come into it, they'll use it intensely for a certain period of time, they will love it, and then after a certain period of time, they're kind of done with it. They're, because it is entertainment, it's a game, right? And so you come into it, you enjoy yourself, you leave. I saw that behavior myself with Turntable.fm. So when I love Turntable.fm, I really wanted the monkey. the monkey suit guy. And so I would, you know, I would like sit in my room. I'd think of like the best songs I possibly could. I'd got all these points, and it was really great, and it was really fun, and I love that service. But for me, it didn't solve a true problem, right? It was more entertainment. It was more of a game. And so I kind of fell off the wagon there. And so I think that, you know, overall, does the product solve a true kind of pain point? And if it does, then users are going to have high motivation to use it. The second level that we can analyze motivation at is the screen-to-screen level. So, and with, at the screen-to-screen level, I think it's all about feedback. I think it's all about giving users kind of positive feedback as they go along. And so this is kind of a cool product called High Score House. And I was just kind of signing up the other day as a fake proud father. And as I filled out the kind of the email field, like in it kind of like a little check came up, and the sign up meter filled up a little bit, and that just made me feel kind of good, right? It was a little positive piece of positive reinforcement, a little reward. So I was like, oh, that's great. And the fact that it just looks so good just kind of it pushed me to go forward. And so I think that, you know, on screen to screen level, just giving users positive feedback, little rewards for doing things correctly, can actually work to increase motivation. We see feedback on not as real time of a, you know, kind of schedule with kind of other behaviors on other social networks, right? So like on Facebook, for example, I posted this drawing I did the other day, and ran, you know, I got like 3 likes, I got all these comments, and so that's just like another level of you know, feedback or reinforcement, where it's I posted something, even though it's not in real time, I did get rewards back from that. Twitter is doing this with their new interaction kind of page, where, you know, you can come to this page and get like just little kind of like you can get feedback. You can get these like this positive feedback. These people followed you. This spam bot is shooting a random link at you. So you can kind of get this positive reinforcement there. And I mean, that's just classic kind of operant conditioning, you know, kind of reward user behaviors with positive feedback of different, you know, quantity of different at different frequencies and of different sizes at different times. And I'll put more information on my blog about operant conditioning and how to kind of like really think about it. I just don't have enough time to go into it today. So I think, you know, let's now kind of go into the final member of the trio, which is going to be trigger. Some, you know, really kind of classic, just, yeah, I mean, the kind of the best example, or the, like, I'd say the most used digital trigger is going to be the email, right? So every night I get this email from O-Life saying, how'd your day go? And it kind of prompts me to go in and write a little diary entry. And so that's just a good example of a trigger. Kind of one of the most famous triggers of all time is the Facebook kind of photo notification. So, hey, somebody posted a photo of you. Come check it out. And there are a lot of things. That's a very complex trigger, actually, because it's not just telling you to perform an action, but it's also kind of mixing in some... one, it's making it really easy for you to go and view the photo by giving you a link, right? So it's increasing your ability as well. And it's also kind of bringing a little bit of, like, motivation and kind of vanity in there by saying, you know, you could look like shit, so come check it out and untag it if you have to. So, I mean, there's a little threat in there as well. So it's a pretty layered trigger. And I think that there are 2 main categories of triggers, right, for the web. You have on-site triggers, and you have off-site triggers. So off-site trigger would be these emails that I just showed you, right? So you're not on the site, you're not on the in the app or whatever it may be, and you get these little notifications, these triggers to pull you back in, pull messages. Hey, come on back. Come enjoy it. Come back. Come back to the community. Come back to the service. Remember, we're here. And I think that those are extremely important, and that actually one of the main problems I kind of see with different products or services or different companies I work with is that, you know, they'll build this product or service, and they'll release it to the world. And, you know, of course, because they've been working on it for so long and they see all the different intricacies of it and how it's helped their own lives, they're just like, this product's amazing. People are just like, it's so memorable, it's so great, people are going to love it. So then users come, sign up for the product, use it a little bit, and then go on. And because they're getting probably like 10 invites a day for like other various products, they just forget about it, right? It's just so easy to forget about these things. And so without an email trigger or some other, you know, form of trigger, you can use SMS, other things like that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that users are probably going to forget about you, and you actually should probably create a really good kind of email trigger that provides users with value and other things like that, and send it off to them on some at some regular frequencies to bring them back in. And so I think that those are offsite triggers, and they're very important, right? So offsite triggers, here's some other examples. Text message saying, did you take your pill yet? Great deal on the computer, check it out, right? These are all calls to action. They're asking the user to perform a behavior. Here's like another example of one that's, you know, it's not an online trigger, but just write your daily action plan sticky note. You know, just and anything really can be a trigger, but really, like, for example, if you're just walking down the hallway and you just get a thought of like let's say a song pops in your head, like, oh, like let's say Rihanna's like We Found Love pops in your head or something, and you have your iPhone with you. Like, that was not a planned trigger. That was just, like, a random thought that popped into your head. But it is prompting you to perhaps perform an action. And if you have your iPod with you, if you have your headphones with you, you can actually perform that action. Your ability is high in that moment. And so triggers can really be anything. They can be cues from the environment, these sorts of things. But you know, generally, like, it's not helpful. It's hard to try and design random thoughts to pop into people's heads. It's very easy to do something very explicit, you know, send people an email, send them a text message, whatever it may be. Let's move to the second type of trigger, which is the, I'd call it the on-site trigger. And these are pretty much just calls to action, right? So on this page, you know, I think, you know, there's a big button that says free download. And so that's a very obvious trigger. Free download, please perform this action right now. You know, another example on the iPad page. You know, there's a big button that says pre-order your iPad. So that's a pretty blatant call to action, and that's a trigger to perform an action. You know, and a lot of pages can have a lot of different triggers, right? So here's my Tumblr dashboard. Right, there are, you know, I can write a text post, I can shoot out a photo post, quote post, link post. What is this? What is it? Chat post, audio post, video post. I can you know, look at all the different notes per item on my page. I can reply to this item. I can reblog it. I can heart it. And then there are other kind of actions that I can perform within the sidebar. So there are all these different kind of all these actions kind of vying for my attention. And as I said before, you know, you can really kind of combine the motivation and ability score for kind of every action to see whether or not it goes above for the average user, goes above the kind of the activation threshold. So we can do a kind of a similar thing with the Tumblr page to, I think, more or less try and predict, you know, like what users are going to do and see if it matches up with, you know, the data. And, you know, so this is just kind of my quick shot at it, which is that, and my hypothesis is that, you know, the photo posts, you know, with text posts, it's kind of hard. You have to have something to say. You have to spend time writing it. You have to edit it. And so there's actually kind of like a lower ability and on average to do a text post. With photo posts, it's just like so simple because everybody has, you know, phone cameras these days, and they're taking photos constantly. In general, people are going to have content on hand that they can actually share and kind of like bring to the world. So therefore, I think that, you know, the ability for doing a photo post is generally going to be higher. And in general, photo posts are more interesting to the eye, and so they get more positive reinforcement. People comment on them more often. People share them more often. So, you know, I think that the motivation and ability for photo posts would probably be one of the highest things on this page right here. And then other kind of like low threshold to action or high ability actions is what I'll call them are also going to be, you know, probably more common on this page, like hearting posts, because that just requires one click. It doesn't require you to actually put yourself out there at all. Your ability is extremely high to do it. So pretty much, you know, I did that on this page, and just to kind of see what, you know, what I think kind of the topography of the different kind of actions are going to be on that page. So those are the three kind of main components. And I think that, you know, it's just for you guys, just if you remember one thing, like I said, just ability and motivation are always there. They're always present for any given behavior in any context. You know, think about in what situations is the motivation and ability for, like, you know, the given behavior that I'm trying to design, in which scenarios or contexts, what time of day are these behaviors going to be most, you know, or is the person's ability and motivation to do these behaviors going to be highest? And then in those moments, try to just really kind of put implant a trigger into their lives, right? So Olife, that's email service I showed you before, they send me that email like 8 o'clock at night. And that's a great time because, you know, I'm home from work. I have plenty of free time. I'm just hanging out in the evening. And I get this trigger. Hey, write your diary entry. If they send that to me, maybe at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon when I'm in the middle of all these client emails and things like that, chances are I'm not going to be able to respond. And so I think that, you know, finding periods of high ability and motivation or doing research to figure out these things and then planting triggers within those moments, I think that that's the name of the game. And generally, when you're designing or when you're troubleshooting kind of like behavior change, this is the order you should actually, I think, go in. Is that first, like, let's say a behavior is not occurring within your system, within your product or whatever it may be. And you're just like, okay, like, why isn't this happening? What's going on? First, try and see, do we actually remind them, or do we give them a clear call to action? That's the first thing I think you should always ask. And I think that that generally, or a lot of the times, will solve the problem. Second thing to ask yourself is, one, is this behavior way too hard? Are we asking for too much, right? And if you simplify your system then, and you kind of get rid of all the kind of extra material and cruft, and all the extra information, all the extra steps, generally, by doing those two things, you'll be able to kind of get the result you want. And I'd say that if you generally, if you implant clear triggers and you have triggers built within the system, offsite and onsite, if you've made the system streamlined and simple, and, you know, of course, do user tests and things like that in order to, you know, figure all this out. But if you've done those two steps and you're still not getting good usage and people still aren't using your product, I'd say that generally what you should do is analyze, you know, the question, are we actually solving a true pain point for our users? Are we actually providing them with value? And I think that that's a lot of times the hardest question to kind of ask. And that's why I think gamification has become so popular, is you have a lot of services that really truly aren't giving a lot of value to their users. And so the way that, you know, a lot of people, the idea that people have had is to, okay, we're not getting a lot of engagement. Instead of asking the hard questions such as, are we giving actually any value to our users and helping them? Instead, you know, I think a lot of companies are just putting these reward systems into their products to try and, like, take advantage of, you know, kind of extrinsic motivators, things like that. And, I mean, it's not a sustainable solution, right? Because pretty much the bad path that you get into with these extrinsic motivators is that you have to keep increasing the size of the reward because people habituate to the rewards. You have to actually, like, be very smart about the schedule of reinforcement. And so in the beginning, you're going to want more of, like, a continuous reinforcement. So every time they do an action, here's a little treat. And then over time, you really kind of want to actually vary it. It's called variable ratio reinforcement. So this is like the slot machine mechanics, right? So, you know, a lot of times you give people these little wins in the beginning, and then you just make it completely crazy. And just like, you know, 50% of the time they're winning, and then 30% of the time they're winning. And it's like the brain's, the dopaminergic system is really trying to kind of crack the pattern, crack the code. And so you're hyper aware, you're hyper alert, you're being stimulated constantly. But that's a kind of a hard game to play. And it's not really a healthy one. And it's kind of disrespectful to users to try and kind of get them into this addiction cycle. And so I'd say, you know, if you are thinking about gamifying or putting badges in your system or putting like a point system or a reward system, I'd say step back and kind of see whether or not, one, like I said, triggers, two, whether or not you've made it easy. And then three, whether or not you're solving a true pain point. And I think that that is the way to go. So those are the main ideas. And what I really wanted to do for the rest of the session is that I wanted to actually take user questions and kind of get audience questions. Holy crap, what is going on? All right, audience questions, audience feedback, so that I can really kind of answer some specific kind of ideas you're wrestling with or ideas you have about the model or whatever it may be. So thanks so much, you guys. I think we have microphone people around somewhere.
Hi, I'm Ben Congleton from OLARC live chat, and excellent talk.
Oh, thanks so much.
I had a question. We work really hard to sort of build a connection with our customers.
Totally.
And I was wondering, like, how you've seen sort of connection with the customer, motivation, and kind of inside of motivation, and the role of emotion in motivation as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... So one way that BJ actually likes to break down motivation, he likes to have these things called the three primary human motivators. And the way that he kind of breaks it down is you have the big motivators in his mind are pain, pleasure, hope, fear, and then like social acceptance or social rejection. And yes, like, you know, social acceptance and social rejection are big motivators. And I think that the human connection, actually, and let's step back a little bit and talk about the idea of feedback that I just brought up. If you think of just about human connection in general and just like human interaction, it is the ultimate feedback system, right? It's this beautiful dance where pretty much you're in front of, you're talking to somebody else, you're putting out a different, you know, thought or emotion or feeling or whatever it may be. They are molding to that, responding. And so that's actually the ultimate feedback system. And so I think that, yes, like human interaction, creating a connection with the customer is going to be very rewarding and is going to increase their motivation a lot. So I do think it's an important part of the system. That's one of those things where it's like, you know, you can't really fake it. You just got to, you know, you got to put in the time, put in the energy to like actually have your support team or whatever it may be just connect with your users or your customers. But is that did I kind of hit on what you wanted? Examples of social connection?
So I know like Kevin Hale talks
yeah.
about
yeah. You know, let's talk after this because yeah, that's a more in-depth kind of question. Yeah, okay.
Hey, Wendy Suswanson. I'm a pediatrician working in the space of kind of health communication, and I've heard BJ a number of times, and
cool.
I loved hearing this again. And one question I have for you is these off-site triggers that sometimes I feel really disrespected as the user there, that you're constantly bringing me back. And I just wanted your thoughts about, why don't you just let me interact where you found me? So if I'm in an email and you send it to me, can I have a power email function where I can get what I need and what you want from me without actually having to go back? And if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, totally. That's an example of... I'd say if you have just different kind of actions that users can take within the email, pretty much what you're doing is, if those are the most important actions for your product or service, pretty much what you're doing is you're amplifying the ability of the user to kind of perform that action because you're meeting them where they are right there. That could have actually effects on their motivation over time to use the product or service as well. So I think that's a really great route. I think it's a viable route. But yeah, no, I get where you're coming from, and I think that there is... If you don't provide users with value or make it easy for them, you know, within the trigger itself, of course, over time, they're just going to tire from it or get really annoyed or whatever it may be. I saw that behavior with myself with Groupon, where I was getting all these emails, and I never took advantage of any of them. Even though there were calls to action within the email, I wasn't getting any value from them. So over time, kind of, I think, you know, like my cognitive kind of appraisal of the value of Groupon emails just went way down. I just unsubscribed. And so, but yeah, I think that that's a good approach.
Hey.
Oh, right.
I also have a question about offsite triggers. So with a lot of like social apps and things like this, of course you need to be registered to participate.
Yeah.
Like with the Tumblr example, etc. But with media consumption platforms, apps, or distribution networks, oftentimes you don't have to be a registered user. You just go in and consume the media. Like with YouTube, you don't have to be registered.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a situation like that, the user's ability to participate is very high because they don't have to register at all.
Right? Yeah.
They don't have to validate. They just go in, get entertained, feel good. But then they leave. And so if you're running a company that's largely based on media consumption, what happens to that idea of the offsite trigger when you can't track the user? Like their ability is high, right, to participate. Their motivation might even be high because they feel great. Let's say they go in and watch a webisode. But then the ability to deliver the trigger is very difficult off-site. I work for a company called Broadcaster, and we do location-aware kind of media pinning,
mm-hmm.
right, where you just pop your phone open and here's all the media relevant around you.
Mm.
But you don't have to be registered to do that. So I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Interesting, yeah. Oh, no, that's really interesting. And I think that... That's one of those situations where this is actually one of the few situations I think we're actually kind of... That's actually a really, really, really hard scenario because I think this is one of the few situations where really motivation does become one of the primary things that you are kind of dealing with, right? And kind of creating that match between kind of... Actually, in a certain sense, I think media companies are in the hardest position, right? Because you, in a certain sense, have to read the user's mind or do the closest thing to that, right? A person may, like, I guess, like, location and whether where you are is what we use to kind of, like, kind of guess those things right now. But really, like, let's talk more. Like, to be honest, a lot of these questions are so in-depth and so complex that I can't really give, like, a... Yeah, I'll be around after. I'll talk with you. Yeah, but... Some of these questions are just really complex, yeah.
Well, what do you think about, you said that those triggers and, you know, like she was saying, then you get constant emails. For example, the email that you get every day. Do you think it would be better to give the user the option of when they want to receive these triggers?
Yeah, I think that that's terrific, because what you're doing is you're allowing the user to kind of get involved in the dance of like pretty much what you're doing in that situation is you're telling the user, when are you most able to kind of interact with us? You're getting a sense of their schedule, right? And so you can kind of guess, like, oh, people are going to be free in the morning, people are going to be free in the evening, and maybe at lunchtime, so we'll send our emails during one of those three periods. But really, if you're kind of allowing a user to choose frequency and maybe time of email, I think that then you're pretty much allowing them to kind of tell you, okay, this is when I'm most able to kind of deal with your emails, and actually probably when I'm most motivated as well. And so you're really kind of allowing them to kind of choose or tell you what they know best. Yeah, so I think that that's a good approach.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your talk. I guess like an ethical question.
Yeah.
When you're like 60 years old, let's say, you know, looking back.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on stuff you might regret? Like, did we go too far? Like, this kind of feels like this is like the tobacco industry. Like,
yeah.
Right when things were getting started and they're all figuring out all this addiction stuff.
Oh,
Do you ever feel like there's anything that we should be aware of about the way this might affect people in the long run or something like that?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, I am... I've been very concerned about, in general, just kind of like the state, I guess you could say, of web today and like how it affects kind of our minds, right? And, you know, the research on this is like very, very scant on like how, you know, kind of like web technologies and like constant interruption affects cognition, especially for the long run. But to be honest, I am worried, because I do think that the quality of our lives is dictated by the quality of our attention. Are we able to pay attention to things for a long period of time, kind of notice like small subtleties and like similarities between other things? Are we able to do this deep thinking where we just have sustained attention for long periods? And actually, I think that overall, in a certain sense, like all the services that we're creating are like very addicting, right? Like Twitter's very addicting, Facebook's very addicting. It's awesome. I love it. It's really fun. I enjoy it. But, you know, a lot of people enjoy cocaine as well. And I mean, that doesn't mean it's good for you, right? And like, you know, actually, I kind of think it's kind of interesting where today, I kind of feel we're like back in the day with Freud in Germany, they, you know, had cocaine. And that's where it was isolated within Germany. And pretty much Freud and all these other like psychoanalysts were like, oh, like cocaine, it's like a great treatment for if you're depressed. This is a good pick-me-up. Like overall, just kind of a good substance that people should use. And then pretty much years later, they were like, oh no, this has horrible side effects. It's very addictive. This is not good. And I feel that like maybe we're like, I don't know, but maybe we're in the same situation with web today where it's like, oh, this is awesome. Yeah, like I want to get updates from my friends constantly. I want to see all this information. I want to check out articles and stuff like that. But we're getting addicted at the same time. And I think it is affecting our cognition to a certain degree. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think that that's an interesting question. And I think actually by understanding addiction and by understanding the mechanics behind it, you know, then we'll be able to come up with better treatments. We'll be able to better understand how this is affecting us, like the mechanics behind how it's affecting us, and actually combat it over time. So I think that it's actually good to get this knowledge out there and to get a lot of people kind of on board with it, because then we can actually like fight it and like be intelligent about how we design our products and services. Yeah.
Hi. I'm over here.
Oh.
So I work at a cooperative where we provide visual communication services to local grassroots organizations and nonprofit organizations. And one of the challenges that we have is just that a lot of the organizations are, say, like working on multiple programs. They have like a lot of updates. They have a lot of ways to engage their communities. And when actually putting all of this together in a web design, or like while we're doing the wireframing, there's just so much data and so many ways for people to engage or get information that it can be really overwhelming. And I'm just thinking about what you said with regards to ability and making mm-hmm. things, you know, simplifying things so that to make the, you know, ability to make it make people be actually be able to take these actions. So I'm just wondering if you either have any advice or if you have any examples of websites that are kind of like news heavy or where there's a lot going on, but yet there's like an element of simplicity that enables ability.
Yeah. I think a pretty good example is Flipboard, to be honest. Because in that situation, you really do have like one big item. On a lot of the pages, you have one big item, one kind of main point of focus. On other pages, maybe you'll have two or three points of focus. That's kind of a different kind of, it's kind of different than what you're talking about. I think that it would be good. Let's maybe talk a little bit afterwards, but I know there are examples, just I'm not always the best at recalling them right off the top of my head. So yeah, let's talk a little more later, yeah. Yeah, totally. I'll put all the information up on the blog, and all the slides that I really wanted to share with you guys, kind of about, like I said, neuroscience of addiction, reward schedules, reinforcement schedules, all that. I'll do write-ups on all those too. Put them up there so you guys can check them out. Yeah, it'll be good.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way? How do you determine the threshold when you're graphing?
Yeah. Pretty much the way you determine the threshold is first you implant a trigger. You see whether or not, what proportion of the population is actually kind of like responding to that trigger. And from that, you can pretty much tell, are we over the threshold, right? Because if the motivation and ability is over the threshold, then a trigger should be met generally, or most of the time, with kind of a behavior. So if the trigger's not being met with a behavior, chances are you're not at that threshold for those people in the population that aren't responding to it. So that's pretty much how you do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say... how does risk factor in? Well, I'd say that in general, kind of the main way that I look at ability is I think of all the barriers. I think of all the things that would make things... Like, that's just how I think. Is just, I think about, what would be really hard here? And I try and get rid of every barrier and try and get rid of every potential risk, as you said. That's just how I operate. Other people can, think about it more in terms of positive frame and be like, I'm going to make it really simple and clear and concise, but that's just how I conceptualize it. So yeah, I see it. I generally look at ability in terms of how many ability blockers are there and how do I get rid of them? That's just how I conceive of it though.
Hi, I have a question over here. Front row.
Oh,
hi.
Wow. Yeah.
I work with teachers. Our whole site is about teachers. And when you talk about an audience that has a lot of barriers to time and motivation. And we're very heavily program based and we give a lot in terms of rewards. So I was wondering what your recommendations would be in terms of getting smarter about the optimum times to reach out to them, because we do a lot of offsite triggers via email and everything like that. But each state is different. I mean, each country is different in terms of getting smarter about the audience of when is it in the morning? Is it in the afternoon?
Yeah.
Is it at lunchtime? Just how you gather that information from your end users without having to explicitly go to each one and be like, when do you want to get your...
Yeah. I think that, in that situation, and I don't know all the details of, kind of this this problem, but actually, the kind of the approach that the gentleman over here kind of had earlier, where you actually ask the users, ask each teacher, right? I think that in this situation, you might actually have to get to that level. Have each person kind of fill out maybe a form with different options. Start with the simplest thing, right? So maybe create just a Google Doc or something. Send it out to all, or a Google Form. Send it out to all of them, being like, okay, which of these times is best for you to kind of respond or whatever, maybe. Yeah. I think that you can make it scalable, though, but just by being, right, because everybody's going to have, a certain 15-minute or 30-minute or hour period of time that's going to be, optimal for them. But in this situation, I think, it's kind of a first kind of approach. I don't think you necessarily need to get, fully optimal, but just, much better. And so in that situation, what you can maybe do is you can think, strategically with your team about, okay, in general, when are teachers best able to kind of respond to these things? What type of information do they want to hear? How do they want to be presented? And then maybe come up with, three or four different time slots or, periods, and then do that. And then you could pretty much batch everybody into four buckets, and then you could, using MailChimp or whatever you use to, talk to them, you can pretty much schedule based around those kind of constraints. And I do think that actually would be, kind of a good first pass, is just to, because you can eliminate most periods of the day and just based upon just some quick thinking with your team, so, yeah. All right.
My question was about the... we have a lot of customers. I work for the soaring industry, the Yellow Pages, and we have a lot of customers kind of on the near side of the digital divide. A lot of people that don't receive a lot of email or spend a lot of time online. Is there a greater tolerance in your experience or less of a tolerance to, like, I would say email marketing or frequent triggers like that? I mean, I know we want to schedule emails to follow up with content collection and things like that.
To be honest, most of my experience is based in the kind of early stage startup world, and there generally we're dealing with a much different audience, right? We're not dealing with kind of like your less tech savvy web user. It's generally more kind of like early adopters, right. And so I don't have a great answer for that. Okay. I would say just based upon like just talking to all my relatives and just dealing with individuals in my life that kind of seem to fall in that category. It's actually really weird because I would expect them to be less tolerant of spam, but like my mom is just like, she eats it up, to be completely honest. So she really eats it up, and so does my uncle. Like tons of people in my family love spam, love forwards, and so they seem to be more tolerant to this stuff, which seems weird because it seems to me like they would treat it more like traditional mail, where it's like, I hate you know, all this junk mail. I just want the letter from my doctor or like from my son. But it's weird, yeah.
And you mentioned 8 o'clock p.m. As a kind of a good time for you to receive emails that maybe you weren't asking for. I see the ones that I get are typically in the morning, you know, when I get them from various sources. And I didn't know if you had seen this in practice and this is something you had kind of come to discover or if it's something...
I mean, it seems personally. To me like a lot of the email times that are chosen are I mean, first of all, I think that I'd say that within the kind of like the startup world, there's a lot of copying. And so it's like, oh, like we just need to make a quick decision about like when to send out the email. Oh, these guys are all doing it in the morning. Let's do that. And so you kind of have these trends kind of emerge that really don't necessarily have any like great backing behind them. But I do think that the morning is generally a pretty good time because actually, well, it depends, right? Like you could look at it a couple different ways. Some people, I think a lot of people, I think have, you know, kind of email kind of rituals in the morning. They get up, they check their email, they spend time on it maybe for an hour. Whereas other people are probably going to be very busy and they're not going to be able to get to it in the morning because they're, you know, jumping out of bed, taking their shower really quickly, hopping in the car and going. But for other people, you know, the evening might be better. I think it varies based upon the person, but generally morning and evening, I'd say are probably the freest times, just, you know, just logically, that you could send an email to a person.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So you use the example of cocaine usage.
Yeah.
So typically people won't just start using cocaine. They'll start using some other type of drug and then they'll ladder up. They reach some type of tolerance and then they sort of ladder up or descend into madness perhaps. So like what are some ways in which you can see in a gamification system when it's time to change the game, when it's time to ladder to something new? And is there any good research that maybe we could look into to help us sort of figure out when to change the game?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I don't know if the kind of gateway drug hypothesis is correct. But but I would say that there is a lot of research on this, when do you know that you need to ladder up? I mean that's a really hard question, and that's just like a heavy data analysis question, right? Because you're going to start to see drop off. You're going to start to see drop off within the population in general at a certain point based upon the reinforcement schedule that you have, and this is a question that, you know, the kind of like. It really depends on your specific kind of arrangement. It's hard for me to just give you a very general answer for this. But I can point you to some research. Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much, you guys.